Välkomna då till Humpod som är aktuell forskning om ämnen inom konst och humaniora vid Linnéuniversitetet. Mitt namn är Hans Hägerdal och med mig så har jag
Tommy Gustafsson.
Ja, och vår gäst idag är Emilio Audicino och han är docent och han håller på att forska på film och media och han är så mycket som filmmusikolog. Fantastiskt, det visste jag knappt fanns. Welcome, Emilio. Warmly welcome, really. And
tack.
Great.
Tack för inbjuden.
And yeah,
that's all
please.
My Swedish.
Our pleasure, really. And yeah, you are a film historian and a musicologist. And you're not really from here, apparently. You have your roots in Italy, and you have made an interesting journey towards the north. You started out in Genoa, and then you made a stitch at the United Kingdom, and then you came to our very northern university. So can you tell us, in brief, how you ended up here?
Yes, well, I was in the UK because I wanted to specialize in Southampton when there is one of the top film musicologists around, Professor Donnelly. So I was there and then Brexit happened. And so I decided that I didn't want to stay there. My was not a permanent contract yet. So I said, maybe I should relocate before things get worse, which is happening now, particularly in universities in the UK. So I was looking around, and Martin Nust from the Växjö campus invited me as a keynote for a conference that he hosted that year, 2019. And so that was my first time in Sweden, my first time at LNU. And talking with Martin, I said, I'm looking for a permanent job, you know. And he said, keep an eye on our website because there are going to be openings next year. And that's why I arrived here.
Thank you. So here you are. And we're glad to have you here.
Yeah, thanks.
A question about film studies. Yep. Within film studies, film music is a minor or even an ignored subject. Why do you think that is, considering the importance of film music?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because in the old days, well, not so old, but I'm talking about 1980s, the first scholar who basically wrote the first academic books on film music were film scholars, Claudia Gorman, Carol Flynn, because in those days, musicologists kind of shunned film music. Film music is garbage. It's not worth for musicologists to study. So film scholars started the academic discipline of film musicology. Then the next generation of musicologists, they discovered that actually film music had a great value. And so basically they conquered the field. They think, okay, now we're the professional, we're musicologists, and so we are going to do film musicology. And so there was a retreat of film scholar, and there was kind of this is not really our topic, this is not really our field, we should let musicologists do the job. So that's the first reason, it's a disciplinary territory type of thing. The point is that musicologists often approach music as music. So they concentrate on the musical text and so on, not so much on the interaction between music and the other cinematic elements, which is my primary interest, because my background is in film studies, mostly not in musicology. So first reason is that. The other reason is that film studies has a long tradition based on semiotics. So it developed from literary studies and so on. And music is very difficult to verbalize. Music was characterized as an unconsumed sign. So with a semiotic approach, typical of film studies, it's kind of difficult to handle music. So a little bit for disciplinary territoriality, and a little bit because of this semiotic background in film studies, film music was kind of ignored for a long time, yes.
Mm, thank you for that really good answer.
Yeah, really. And we should continue a little bit about approach here and methodology. Now, you have used something called neo-formalism when you analyze this film music. So, what is that, and how do you use that?
Yes, exactly. And this connects with my previous answer, the semiotic background of film studies. Neo-formalism is like an alternate version of film analysis compared to semiotics. So it originated in the early 1980s, University of Wisconsin-Madison, David Bordwell, Christine Thompson, Noel Carroll, these are some of the principal names. And their point was to propose a methodology for film analysis which was not based on semiotics, not based on the communicational model that semiotic is based on, but based on a perception model. So, and the big base was not semiotic, but cognitive psychology and a revision of the Russian formalism of the 1920s. And the point is that, their point is that films are not only there to communicate messages. I always, with my students, I use the metaphor, the simile actually, of the Amazon package. So when you get a package from Amazon, your interest is in the content. So you immediately open the package, you throw away the package because you want the content. So in the semiotic approach, in the approach that neo-formalists were trying to correct, the film form was seen like a box, a package, that was only there to contain the contents, which was the analyst's interest. So they would just take the form and throw it away. And the point of neo-formalists is that film form is important too. We should start analysis with the film form. And the film form has a lot of other aspects than communication, perceptual aspects, the color of the clothes of the actor, the light pattern, the pace of the editing. These are kind of a non-communicational elements of the film, which with the old semiotic approach was kind of a neglected. So the first thing is the difference between communicational model, semiotics, and the perception model, which is neo-formally. And so bring a new attention to the formal aspects of film. And another point that was interesting to me is that the one of redefine film analysis, because film analysis in the 1970s tended to be basically a synonym with film reading, film interpretation, which is about the message. A neo-formalist said, no, actually film analysis should start with the device, the formal aspects of the film, and within the formal aspects of the film, we find the themes, the meanings, the message. So analysis first, interpretation later. Interpretation is part of the analysis. It's not the same thing. And this was very useful for me because I wanted to study film music, not semiotically, but with an approach that should cover also the sensorial, perceptual aspect of film music. For example, why music makes an action scene look faster. If you take music from an action scene, you will notice that the pace of the scene is perceived as slower. And this is something that you cannot really give an answer using semiotics, I think. So that's why I came up with neo-formalism, why I adopted neo-formalism.
Interesting. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to talk about your analysis of film music, and especially about a film called Jaws. And Jaws is directed by Steven Spielberg. It's a classic horror film from 1975 with a classical score by John Williams, of course. And it's instantly recognizable. Everybody knows it. Just two notes. Do-do. And everybody knows that score. You claim in an article that the music in Jaws is so important that it actually becomes one of the main characters. Could you explain how the music was developed for that film? Yep. And how it becomes a main character?
Yes, just a side note. Coincidentally, today is John Williams' 92nd birthday. So John Williams is 92 today and still very active. So I'm very happy to be able to talk about John Williams today specifically. And Jaws was one of the films that launched John Williams. Because why music is a character in film? Because, well, the first thing was a very practical thing. If you are familiar with the production of the film, the production was a nightmare. The crew had a nickname for the film, not Joes, but Flows. Because they had this mechanical shark who costed $750,000. And the first time it was put in seawater, it sank. So the problem of the film was it's a film about a killer shark. So the shark is the protagonist, but they couldn't use the mechanical shark for most of the time. So Spielberg had to come up with improvisation, other ideas to keep the shooting going on, because, you know, if you stop shooting, it's a lot of money that going to waste without the star of the film, because the shark was not working. Indeed, if you watch the film, you don't see the shark until 1 hour into the film, and the total visible presence of the shark in these 2 hour films is six minutes. So one of the methods to replace the shark that was not there was music. So John Williams' music made the presence of the shark tangible and real, even if there is no shark, actually. Another way was the point of view shot, of course, that we know. So the first way was to cover for these mechanical flows of the film Jaws, and where the shark was not working, and so the music actually replaced the protagonist of the shark. But the other element is how brilliantly the music is written. Because the music is very simple, primordial. It's just two repeating notes. Dum, 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 bum, 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 bum. And these notes is, the shark is like a killing machine. So it's the concept, the shark in the film is this perfect, primitive killing machine, unstoppable. And so the concept of John Williams was to use this musical device, which is called an ostinato. That's an Italian word that means stubborn. And ostinato is music that is built on a very small repeated cell of notes. And the ostinato is like a musical engine. Tom, 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 tom. And so this type of two notes could be accelerated or decelerated. And when you hear that in the film, you don't see the shark on the water, but you understand if a music goes tom, 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 that the shark is swimming faster. You don't see the shark really, but in your mind you can see that, because the music is telling you the shark is approaching now. So it's a protagonist because it had to be, because there was no mechanical shark, and also because a protagonist very effectively because of how the music is built. Instead of a It's interesting because actually Spielberg asked Williams to build a more complex, sinister melody. He wanted a sinister melody for the shark. And Williams said, yeah, don't worry, I'll think about that. And the first test when Spielberg went to John Williams' house to hear the notes, Williams says, this is the theme for the shark. Bum, 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 bum. And Spielberg burst into a laughter. So you're joking, right? No, this is the music you need for this film. And so Williams was right. Yeah.
The score for Jaws became a huge success, of course. Everybody knows it now. And you could even say that it revived the use of symphonic music in Hollywood, which Hollywood had used in the classical Hollywood period from the 30s up to the 60s. And you are also talking about, and others, about a neoclassical era for symphonic music. Could you briefly explain how the classical Hollywood era used symphonic music and how it was challenged in the 60s?
Yes. So, my claim is that Jaws was the very first film of this neoclassical period, which was blossomed with Star Wars 2 years later. So Star Wars is a perfect example of what I call neoclassical film score. And sometimes there is some confusion, because in musicology, in music history, neoclassical is used for another type of composition. So it's the 20th century composers, Stravinsky, Respighi, in the myth, who basically wanted to go against the romantic music and going back to the 18th century music, so the classical music of Haydn, Mozart, etc. I use neoclassical in terms of film music that revive the music style that was used in the classical Hollywood cinema, as per the famous title of the Borwell, Steiger and Thompson book. And that music of the classical Hollywood cinema, which we can date between the early 1930s and the late 1950s, was characterized by a specific musical dialect, which was one of the one of the late 19th century music. Wagner, the opera that followed Wagner, Puccini also, there is a lot, but Mahler, Richard Strauss. So the music, the late Romantic music that bridged the 19th century and the early 20th century. So that was the dialect used for those scores. And also they imported that some techniques from opera, for example, the leitmotif from Wagner. And the leitmotif is this musical technique by which every principal character or concept in opera, but also in film and, by transmission, is identified with a very recognizable musical motif. So the hero has a specific theme, the villain another, and there's a love theme, etc. And you create a musical dramaturgy, basically a musical retelling of the story by intersecting this leitmotif. So a typical elaboration is that if the hero is triumphant, we hear the hero's motif in a triumphal major mode. If the hero experiences a setback and a sadness, the motif is modulated into minor mode. So this was the dramaturgical approach, and this was brought to Hollywood as a technique. And another famous technique was so-called Mickey Mousing that was imported from cartoon music. So classical Hollywood music was very adherent to visual action. And so if you think about the Tom and Jerry cartoons, when the Jerry Mouse would tiptoe, you would listen pizzicato strings, which basically each pizzicato string would replicate each step of Jerry Mouse. That's Mickey Mousing, music that mimics the visual action. And in the classic Hollywood cinema, dramatic film used these techniques too. Max Steiner, one of the names of classical Hollywood music, used a lot of this type of Mickey Mouse approach. And finally, we have the symphonic orchestra, which was the ensemble that would be used in the classical Hollywood cinema. In the 1960s, there was a change of fad, partly because there was a new type of audience, which was not as familiar as the previous audience with opera or late romantic symphonic music and so on. So there was a need of bringing new styles and new musical dialect, jazz, Latin American music, pop music and whatever, what was called easy listening at the time. But also, in that period, Hollywood was undergoing a severe crisis. That's the end of the studio system. So Hollywood had to find another way to make money. And a strategy that was used was a synergy between the film studios and the record market. So a successful film, to be successful, had to earn from the box office, but also earn from the record market by using pop songs that you could sell on LP albums. We have to think that in the 1950s, there was the invention of the long playing disc, where you could put on more songs and so on. So 1960s cinema had to cater to a younger audience, so more modern musical style. But also they were desperate for selling discs. And so to sell disc, pop songs were kind of a mandatory in films. And then there's a famous example, Butch Cassidy, this film about these two bank robbers that is set in the early 20th century. And there is this infamous scene of the bicycle ride in Butch Cassidy when all of a sudden a Burt Bacharach song starts and there is Paul Newman riding the bicycles and has no meaning at all for the story. So you could cut that scene and the film would standalone anyway. So that's like an early version of a music video, actually. It's clearly an advertisement for Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, the famous Burt Bacharach song. And that's typical of the 1960s scene. So all the late romantic musical style, the leitmotif, the Mickey Mouse, these old techniques, but also the symphony orchestra as the musical means to record music, they went out of fad in the 60s. And they were revived by John Williams, Jaws, and particularly Star Wars.
Right. And you mentioned opera, and I'm spontaneously thinking about The Godfather 3, uh-huh. And you have the final scene with all the murders, and it's sort of integrated in a famous Italian opera. So, opera and film music, after all, they may be a little bit similar, that they emphasize a certain sequence or a state of emotion. So is it two sides of the same coin, or maybe fundamentally different after all?
Yeah, well, in a little bit, yes, of course, because the founding fathers of Hollywood music, they were opera composers. Mm. The most famous was Erich Wolfgang Korngold, who actually was a gift from the Nazi to Hollywood, because he ended up in Hollywood because he was a Jew, and he had to flee Vienna when there was the Anschluss, and so when the Nazis invaded Austria. So, of course, these opera composers, they brought the expertise in opera to Hollywood. And so that's the root of film music. But I would say there are differences, and that's going back to musicologists sometimes not having a cinematic approach. They sometimes use a kind of a dramaturgical analysis of film music as the same they would use for opera music. So the interaction basically between the musical text and the story that is being told. But there are elements that you don't have in opera. For example, the relationship between music and film editing. Because music has a rhythm, a pace of its own, and film editing is also very musical. And the French silent cinema, they say that cinema is visual music. So there is an, and of course in opera we don't have this relationship. So one thing that typically musicologists tackling film, they neglect, is the aspect of film editing. They would focus on the acting, the storytelling, as if it were an opera. But this is an element that, and another interesting element of difference between opera and film is the more ambiguous interplay that you have in film between what's called diegetic and non-diegetic music. So diegesis is the story world, the world that is inhabited by the characters of the film and so on. So diegetic music is a type of music that we hear as viewers when we watch the film, but that the characters in the film, they can also hear that music. So, for example, a radio that is playing in a scene and the character are dancing to the music, that's diegetic music. It's part of that diegesis. But then there is non-diegetic music, which is the typically music that accompanies a scene. Jaws, tom, 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 tom. That's non-diegetic music, because if the swimmer heard that, they would, of course, rush back to the beaches, of course. So they cannot hear that. We hear that as viewers, and we said to the swimmer, go away, go away. But they cannot listen to the music. So that's a basic difference. And films, they often play beautifully on the ambiguity of where the question is, where is the music coming from? Is this diegetic or non-diegetic? And there are a lot of plays. One is Miller Crossing. There's a famous, this is a Coen Brothers gangster film. And there is a beautiful scene of, with the Tommy gun killing, the machine gun, etc., which is set to Danny Boy, the Irish ballad. And there is a fantastic passage, because Danny Boy is played on a turntable, on a gramophone, so it's clearly diegetic. But then at the end of the scene, the music kind of transcend the real world and becomes non-diegetic. So films are rich of these moments, which you cannot really have in opera, because in opera, the musicians are there, you can see them. So in a way, they are part of a world. So I would say that these are two the big differences. In opera, you don't have the relationship with editing, of course, and you can't play this beautifully with these two narratological levels. Yeah.
Right. Now, I would like to say a little bit about your theoretical concepts that you use in your research. And one of these concepts is Gestalt. You study the functions and the effect of music in film. And could you explain a little bit how that help us understand the subject? Although I understand that Gestalt is not really a musicological term, right?
Yeah. So Gestalt, it's a school of psychology that was popular in the early 20th century. And I typically like out-fashioned things. So when I looked for theories, I went for Gestalt because it was outmoded. And so that's typical of me. I was looking for a kind of a theoretical framework to explain why, for example, we hear to a piece of music and we say, oh, this piece of music is so sad. How is it possible that music is able to convey a feeling of sadness? And Gestalt is quite useful to me in that sense, because Gestalt has this concept of isomorphism. So the idea is that there are universal Gestalt qualities that we find in different sensorial realms. So there is a Gestalt of sadness, for example, that we can identify in a photo of a sad face. So we would have, you know, the mouth like this, the sad eyes, a sense of lack of energy in the expression. So that would be a Gestalt quality of sadness in the visual realm. But we can also detect a Gestalt of sadness in the musical realm. We hear Chopin's funeral march. Dum, dum, da-dum, dum, da-da-da-dum, da-dum. That's sad music, clearly. I think everybody would say, why is that? Because it has some Gestalt qualities that are typically of the sadness Gestalt. The slowness, dark tones instead of brighter tones. Even if you think about how a sad person walk, it would have this sense of lack of energy, the shoulder would be down, it would move in a slow way. So the theory of isomorphism is that there are these Gestalt qualities which are transsensorial, different realms. And so I base on this theory the power of the music to translate emotion and states into music. And actually, Gestalt was used by a music theorist, Leonard B. Mayer, and he based his work on Gestalt theory. And he called this quality of music metaphoric mimicry, the power of translating into music physical. So, for example, if you have to write music for an elephant, you typically would use the counter basses, a tuba, heavy sounding instrument, because there is this Gestalt of heaviness and bigness. And so you would go for the big sound. If you write music for a little bird, you would use flute or even the piccolo, which is the flute that's even higher. And so you see, that's what Mayer calls metaphoric mimicry. Music mimics certain aspects of the real world. And another final example of Gestalt, which I find very interesting. One of the Gestalt fathers, Wolfgang Kohler, he actually used musical example to demonstrate this. And there is an experiment that he made which actually demonstrate this isomorphism between different sensorial realms. And it's called the Takete Maluma experiment. And I don't know if you can just... I know it's a podcast, so you cannot see, but now I'm drawing this kind of a spiky figure here. And then I'm drawing a figure with soft lines on the other side. So these two figures were shown to two test groups. And to these two figures, the two groups were asked to assign to one figure and to the other one of two invented words. One word was takete, and the other was maluma. Every person in the groups associated maluma with the figure with the soft contours, well, everyone would associate takete with the spiky, curvy figure. So this is a famous experiment by Kohler to demonstrate these Gestalt qualities that are in different sensorial realms.
Okay, time flies, and we always end our podcast with a guest reflecting over one of Ellen Yu's value words. nytta, nyfikenhet, nytänkande och närhet, which is in English usefulness, curiosity, innovative thinking and proximity. Yeah. So, do you want to reflect on any of these words, Emilio?
Yeah. So I would say innovative thinking, I hope, because I mean, I was lucky to publish actually the first academic book on John Williams. So, you know, and it was a moment of pride. Last year in New York, I was at the music and the moving image conference at the New York University, which is the biggest film music conference in the world. And I had to give a paper, and I was introduced as the founder of the John Williams studies. So, yeah. So, yeah, in a way, I always try to be, we have no time to mention here, but another research area that it's pretty innovative is my work on the Zucker Abrams Zucker films. So this trio of comedy filmmakers. And there is, I published two articles. And before these articles, there were no academic literature on these. So I always try to fill gaps when I can. And then curiosity, of course, I think that's the basic quality of any academic. You have to keep curious about what happens but for example, now I'm very curious and also a bit scared about what's happening with AI and filmmaking. There was this big strike in Hollywood by the screenwriters and the actors, which was specifically about the threat of AI on Hollywood. So that's something that, yes, concerns me very much for now. And I do hope usefulness, but I'm not the judge of that. So I do hope that what I do can be useful to somebody, yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Emilio.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ni har alltså lyssnat på Humpod, aktuell forskning om konst och humaniora vid Linnéuniversitetet. Tack så mycket.